specific frequencies, Dick. Go ahead. Well done, Hal. You came through completely that time. Yeah. These three-letter agencies. It turns out that every piece of sheet metal on your automobile, for instance, the fender that's slightly insulated from the rest of the body of the car, the side view mirror, the rear view mirror, the speaker in the back of the car. There's all kinds of ways you can convert those things into antennas. And of course, they're the wrong length to be resonant. But with the right kind of a stub, you can make them resonant. You can make them a good impedance match at your chosen frequency. And as I said, it's a little bit of a tricky process to know how to do that. You got to start off with knowing the real impedance of the antenna, and there's ways you can design the location and length of the stub. Those are the two variables. You got to choose the right position along the cable. It may be half a foot or 1.5 feet back from the antenna. There's an exact position and an exact length of stub that you're going to put there. And you can choose short circuit or open circuit stub, two different lengths that'll do the job, which will do the complete correction of the standing wave ratio of the antenna. And know for a fact, I didn't say it's easy, but there is the possibility of using more than one stub and properly correcting a stub so that it gives you the correction at more than one band. You maybe can correct the 10-meter band and the 6-meter band simultaneously. I didn't say it's easy, but it's within the laws of physics you can do that. So standing wave ratio, it's a highly misunderstood area, Steve, but it's an area that as you dig into it and you find out that it's really not that bad, I mean, it's just a reflection coefficient. I mean, if, let me drop a comment. Hal recognized. Forgot what I was going to say. So there's ways you can make the match at more than one frequency. I didn't say it's easy, but it's something worth studying. And transmission lines, if it's a so-called 50-ohm transmission line, it wants to see nothing but a pure 50-ohm resistor at the far end. The fact that you've got 50 ohms of capacitance at the far end, that's not good enough. It's going to be a 50-ohm resistor, and then the cable is happy. Anything other than a 50-ohm resistor, any amount of reactance, any amount of resistance that's higher or lower than 50 ohms, you're going to get a calculatable amount of energy reflecting back from the end of the cable. That's just the laws of physics of transmission lines. It's a calculatable amount that comes back, and there's ways you can cancel that from happening by stubs, antenna tuners, also using the Berkeley equation, by going to the program at Berkeley. You Google the word Berkeley, Berkeley, plus impedance match. They got this beautiful program that you tell Berkeley, this is the impedance of my antenna, this is the frequency I'm operating at. You press go, and Berkeley will give you 16 solutions. You put an inductor of this size and a capacitor of that size at the end of the cable, and you get a perfect impedance match to that particular antenna. Berkeley will give you that solution. And to wind your own inductor and to choose the right capacitor, it's not a big deal. K6DPZ, K2RIW, go ahead, Al.
IW, K6DPZ. I was very involved with the Sky's antennas on the West Coast. So we used line stretchers and got the line stretchers adjustment to the proper length. And we made up the coaxial stubs and everything. And it worked fantastic. You had to play with a line stretcher as a stub and the main part. Once you had the length, you made the fittings and off you went.
So as you guys can tell, there's multiple ways of doing it. With the line stretcher, you can find the magic length of line, which makes impedance matching a lot easier. With the right size stub in the right location, you can get a perfect match. By putting an inductor and a capacitor at the end of the cable as an L network, the right size inductor and capacitor will give you a perfect impedance match. So don't let standing wave ratio intimidate you. The fact that it's been poorly explained to you up till now, and it's got a little bit of mystery to it, you're in good company. I think 90% of the electrical engineers in business today do not have a warm, fuzzy feeling of standing wave ratio and how to correct it. 90% of the electrical engineers do not really understand it. So you're in good company. And the fact that you maybe don't feel comfortable with it right now, let that bother you. Come back next week and the next week after that. Ask more questions. You'll eventually find out it ain't that bad. It's just mysterious because we have not been properly taught what it is and how to correct it. Kilo Delta 2, Hotel Uniform Charlie, K2LAW in the TechNet. You got it, Steve.
Well, I got to tell you, that's great news, Dick, because, you know, when I installed the transmission line that I have now, you know, it's a dual-band antenna, and trying to find a point in which both bands happen to hit a half wavelength was no easy task, and actually, rhythm to find it, and managed to hit a spot, you know, the velocity factor of the cable, and I found a sweet spot. But now I'm going to be upgrading to actually 7/8 hard line, and I'm dreading that to go back and do this all again. So just, you know, cable, you know, installable link, and not have to worry about. Back to you, Dick.
You're on the right path, Steve. There's nothing magic about half wavelength of cable length going to your antenna. Unfortunately, now that you know the truth to this dirty little secret, that there's nothing magic about half wave, I don't know where the hell that came from. There are people who think that when you're making a measurement with a Berg watt meter, that the Berg watt meter will lie to you as to the forward power and reverse power if the transmission line is not a multiple of a half wavelength. I don't know where the hell that crazy old wives' tale came from, but there's lots and lots of guys that believe it. Now that you know what I'm reasonably convinced is the higher truth, there's nothing magic. You can make that wait. You can make that transmission line quarter wave, half wave, three-quarter wave, 7/16 wave, whatever you like. Lay that cable the way you want. Don't waste cable because you will get some extra loss. And even the extra loss you get is usually not a showstopper. Lay the cable the way you want to. Don't worry about the length. Don't even calculate the length. Unless you're trying to do the real exact piece of science. And that is, if you know the exact insertion loss of your cable and its velocity factor, if you know the exact length of the cable, then when you use a well-calibrated antenna analyzer in the shack with the right kind of mathematics of knowing the cable impedance, length, and loss, you can now calculate exactly what the impedance of the antenna is, as if you had made the measurement right at the antenna at the top of the tower. So that's the only thing magic about length of cable, where you'd like to be able to make the measurement in the convenient place. Let me drop the comment, Dick. Hal recognized you'd like to make the measurement at the convenient place in the shack. And now that allows you to predict exactly what the impedance is at the antenna, as if you had made the measurement at the antenna. I don't recommend you do this, because it's a pretty high technology way of trying to anticipate. There's a couple of ways that you can get erroneous answers with this one. Not knowing the exact velocity factor of the cable, for instance. The exact approach would be to put the antenna tuner right on the antenna. Well, sometimes that's inconvenient. If it's 100 feet of tower on a windy, icy day, and maybe you don't want to go there. And maybe you want a ballpark figure as to how bad the antenna is. Making a measurement in the shack can give you a lot of good information, in my opinion. I wonder if Hal has done that also. K60PZ, T2RAW in the TechNet. K60PZ. Well, the half wavelength of length of coax, the main reason I use them is a 4-to-1 type of speed step up. You know, you got exact, you got a 4-to-1 step up. But as far as the deal, half wavelength to read the end of the line, it's not no big deal. I agree with you totally, Dick. But as far as, let's say you want to run a transmission line and you want to have the minimum of loss, use a half wavelength converter at the driving end and pick it up at the other end. You have less loss if you have a very long run of cable you want to run. How do you like that one, Dick? Okay, the so-called quarter wave impedance matching transformer that you put at the far end. If you put it in the right location where the impedance is purely resistive, and if you make the quarter wavelength cable the right impedance to correct the visor of the antenna, 60-ohm antenna plus quarter wavelength device, and now the rest of the cable sees nothing but 50 ohms. Therefore, I don't think you have to put another one of those in the shack. Give me a correction on that one, Hal. K6DBZ, K2LIW.
They're making up a 4-to-1. You come in at 50 ohms, half wave, the steps are up 4-to-1. Take it 4-to-1 impedance, go a long distance, at the other end put a 4-to-1 step it back down. They have a very low loss method of feeding at a distance of an antenna system.
I think I hear what you're saying, Hal, and you and I are going to have a considerably longer offline discussion on this subject, because this is a slightly complicated technique, and not everyone is going to know how to do that, if you know what I mean. So the main point I'm trying to make here, Steve, is don't be intimidated by standing wave ratio. Almost all of us have trouble with it, but once you dig in deep enough, it is understandable. It's not magic. It's just simply reflection, that how much reflection you're going to get is a function of how far you are from 50 ohms resistive on the antenna impedance at the end of that cable. The exact formula happens to be antenna impedance, let's call it Z antenna, ZA minus 50 ohms over ZA plus 50 ohms. That formula tells you how big is the reactance going to be, and if you plug in the conjugate impedance for the ZA on top of that equation, you'll now know in the shack exactly what you're going to see, reactive component, resistive component. This formula is what I'm trying to say. So back to you, and don't be afraid to come back and ask us more questions on this screen, Steve, because almost every amateur, to some degree, on some day, is going to run into standing wave ratio problems in his antenna installation. We're all going to live through this. KD2, HUC, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Well, I trust what you said.
KC2WGB. Yes, Dick, I have one simple one from a young scientist. We'll do that one first. That'll be easy. And then we'll go on to another one. But I'd like to let it drop in case anybody on IRLP or Echolink or anybody out there in the cow pasture would like to get in. So we'll give it a few seconds.
This is NY28. I just had a quick question related to the topic just discussed.
Go right ahead, Lou.
Thank you. This has to do with the impedance versus resonant frequency. For example, we're not going to touch the antenna, but we know, let's say it's resonant at 3.5 megahertz, and to us it means it's showing us 50 ohms, if I'm correct. If I were to put together a rig that had a Pi network of 100 ohms, and I used cable that was characteristic 100 ohms, and plugged it into that exact antenna without changing that antenna, would it resonate at a different frequency?
The answer is yes. The magic of resonance is that, as you've heard me say, Sadan, many times, if you want the antenna to radiate, these seven words should be printed on the front cover of every antenna book that has ever been written. I know of no antenna book that says it anywhere in front to cover the back cover. If you want to radiate, you first have to resonate. Or another way of wording it is, you first resonate, then you can radiate. You've got to make the structure resonate. Now, the structure, the radiating system has to resonate. The radiating system consists of the thing that your eye tells you is the antenna. Usually there's some transmission line connected to it and or a balance connected to it. And in many cases, the Pi network that used to be in the final stage of our tube transmitters in the old days, that combination, the radiating system, consists of the final tube, the Pi network, the transmission line, the balun if there is one, and the antenna. You're going to resonate that system, that radiating system. Now, if the pure antenna itself is resonant without the rest of the system, it's a little bit easier because it means the transmission line is not going to be running with a high standing wave ratio. But as long as the transmission line is low enough in loss, then you can do all of the resonating and radiating, reestablishment of resonance in the Pi network of the transmitter. So that 3.5 megacycle dipole, let me drop. You've got a dipole that is perfectly resonant at 3.5 megs. Maybe it's a 130 foot long piece of 14 gauge wire. And today you want to use it at 4.0 instead of 3.5, where it's going to be quite inductive. It's probably going to be a 5-to-1 standing wave ratio. You've tuned it for 3.5, but today you want to use it at 4.0. And up there it's a 4-to-1 standing wave ratio, a 5-to-1 standing wave ratio, which means you've got a lot of reflected energy on that transmission line. And that means that your Pi network is not looking at 50 ohms anymore. For all we know, it's looking at 500 ohms, so to speak. However, as long as your Pi network, the tuning and loading control, does not run out of range, as long as you can reestablish resonance of the whole radiating system and the right impedance match so that the final tube, the 6146, sees its favorite impedance, then the whole system will work like a charm. So therefore, you have literally, by way of the Pi network, moved to a 3.5 meg antenna to be a 98% efficient antenna at 4.0 megs. You're resonating the radiating system. It's not only the antenna. It's the whole thing, everything radio-wise connected to it. It's a lot better off. You're a lot better off than you know, Lou. NY2H, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay. I don't want to do any matching. What I want to know is there, in other words, the whole system is matched. 50 ohms, I think, is something man-made. Right? We've decided on that by convention. I want to know if we decided at 75 ohms, 100 ohms, 450 ohms, which we do, could we put that into the same physical antenna that resonates to, and would that be resonant at some other frequency? Would that same dimensionally cut antenna be resonant at a different frequency and match the new characteristic impedance straight through? We have a new impedance. We're getting knows. That's all I want to know.
The answer is it's going to work like a charm. I'm going to give you an indirect sounding answer at first, Lou. If because you and I decide that my favorite kind of transmission line is open wire 600 ohm, and ordinarily a half-wave dipole resonated is something in the vicinity of 72 ohms resistance, but you want to use 600 ohm open wire line, and you want the whole thing to be matched with no impedance matching structures anywhere in the system, can you do that? And the answer is yes. You go to that article that's in Mike Number 2's website, where K2RIW is telling you how to get a perfect impedance match to a dipole. And you read that article two or three times in a row in order to finally absorb the concept. The concept is the following. This is the world's best kept secret, Steve. I mean, Lou. And that is, Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward made these magic measurements in 1947. And it's been in every issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook ever since. If you look at those curves, you'll realize, let me drop. If you take that dipole slash monopole and extend its length, the resistive component that used to be 72 ohms, you can make it anything from 1 ohm to 1500 ohms inclusive by doing nothing but adjusting the length. You add some extra length to your dipole, and the 72 ohms will go up to exactly 600 ohms if that's what you want. There's a magic length that will do that, but there's a catch. When you add the extra length, from the simplistic point of view, you've knocked it out of resonance by extra length. You think it's now tuned to a lower frequency. Not necessarily. Because you've added that extra length, the Brown and Woodward curve, you've now used only the resistive curve. You found that's the right length to give you exactly 600 ohms. Now you're going to have some inductance left over. If you're willing to put the right capacitor directly across the terminals of that dipole, you will make the reactive component go to zero. You've now got a new antenna on your favorite frequency, 3.5 megs, with exactly 600 ohm impedance. You did nothing but change the length and add a capacitor across the center to get rid of the inductive component that's left. So therefore, once you know what you're doing with those Brown and Woodward curves by reading that article, let me drop. You can make your dipole antenna any impedance in the world that you fall in love with. I don't care if it's 1,000 ohms, 600 ohms, 450 ohms, 72 ohms, 30 ohms, 10 ohms. By choosing the right length, you will make the resistive component of your antenna exactly that number of ohms. In general, there's going to be some reactants left over, except for the 272 ohm case. Put the right capacitor or inductor across the tuning, across the two terminals of that dipole. The reactive component goes away. The resistive component, you've already matched it, and now you're hunky-dory. There's a slight catch to what I said, and that is for mechanical reasons, putting the reactor across the terminals of the antenna in parallel instead of in series, it is a two-step process. In other words, there's a little bit of interaction between the resistive component and the reactive component. But you as an amateur will find that new solution in 10 minutes. Don't worry about it. If you could put the reactor in series with the elements of the dipole, in one step you would be there. Because mechanically, you'd much rather put it in parallel. There's a little bit of interaction, and you got to do a little bit of readjusting, but that's easy. I wonder if this is some of the answer you're looking for, Lou. And this, by the way, is a well-kept secret. Make sure you don't tell anybody. NY2H, K2RIW.
Thank you very much. And we're going to let it go at this because I know the students, well, they're off tomorrow. But in any case, we'll give it back to John very soon. Yes, and what I failed to take into account was an antenna type like a dipole has a characteristic impedance. That really was the underlying part of the question. And I perfectly understand what you say. So you get your resistance by length, and then you null out the capacitive and inductive reactants to zero. So the answer is no. I was almost thinking there was no characteristic impedance, that everything was kind of made by convention, but there is. Physics says there is a characteristic impedance to a particular antenna type, and that's why we can adjust the resistance. and then we have to counter the reactants that you've been out. Got it. Thank you. Thank you very much. NY2H.
I'm going to add a couple words to that one, Lou. With the usual diameter of the wires that you and I use to make a dipole, and when we make it a half-wave dipole, the impedance comes out 72 or 73 ohms. There's nothing magic about that diameter of wire. On 80 meters, I'll admit that I'm not going to use wire that's a 5 feet in diameter. I'm going to use a 14-gauge household wire, which is what, 16th of an inch, 3/32, something like that, for convenience. However, if you and I are building dipoles and Yagis and whatever at 915 megacycles, because we're building antennas for our cordless telephone or for our RFID reader, now you've got a hell of a lot of capability to make the dipole out of very wide sheets of copper tape. And now you can make the characteristic impedance of that dipole a hell of a lot lower number. You make the copper tape wide enough, and I think the characteristic impedance of the antenna is going to be 40 ohms instead of 72 ohms. So the 72 or 73 ohms is only because of the usual diameter of wire we use to make the dipole. Back to you for any comments on that one, Lou. NY2H, good questions. K2LIW.
Very good, yes. So I had, I guess they're more broadband too, but anyway, that's enough for now. We got to turn it over to John. Very good answers. Forget about the questions, the answers are great. Thank you, Dick. NY2H.
You keep saying words like that, Lou, and I'll keep paying you. The check's in the mail. Okay, there's a lot more to simple dipoles than first meets the eye. Every time I've offered any of the magazine publishers this inner information about a dipole and the way you could be using it, they almost always reject it because they think everybody understands dipoles. It's too simple an antenna. There's a lot more going on in there than first meets the eye. Go ahead, John, with your first science question. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the tech net.
K2WGB. Okay, I'm going to let it drop again, and we'll give it a couple of seconds, see if anybody else wants to come in first. Okay, very good. Yes, I have a young gentleman here who happened to have a 2-liter bottle of soda, and he has a question about what's going on, and maybe you could help him out and help him understand this. It was at ambient temperature. It was sitting on the counter. And he noticed when he goes to pick it up, the plastic bottle is quite pliable. But when the bottle leaned over and he stood it back up again, somehow the pressure inside increased and he could not squeeze the bottle anymore. Now, the volume didn't change. Nothing went on. Can you help him out with why did the pressure inside the bottle go up, and how did it do that? And he did mark the liquid level. It stayed the same. No. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Yeah, I think it's called carbolic acid. I'm not sure now. Turns out that the soda that has any fizz to it has carbon dioxide dissolved into the water of the soda. Call it soda water if you like. And there's a significant amount of carbon dioxide dissolved into that water, and it makes something called carbolic acid. It's a slightly bitter taste to the water. As such, there's a huge amount of sugar in every bottle of soda you buy. You know that immediately because if you take that bottle of soda and leave the cap off and leave it for half a day so that all the fizz boils off, and now you're drinking the so-called flat soda, when you do, it tastes so sweet, it's almost sickening. And you ask me, how the hell did that extra sweet taste get in there? Turns out it was always there. Nobody came along in the middle of the night and added sugar to your soda. Let me drop a call. When the carbon dioxide has finally all bubbled out because you've left the cap off and your bottle of soda has gone flat, you're now really tasting the sugar that was always there. The slightly acidic taste from the carbolic acid of the carbon dioxide dissolved into the soda water, the fluid of the soda, canceled some of that sugar taste, and your tongue was fooled into thinking there's nowhere near as much sugar. Also, whenever you've got carbonated water, the amount of carbon dioxide that can be dissolved into the water is highly dependent on the temperature of the water and also whether or not it's been disturbed. We all know that if you take a bottle of soda, open the cap, put your finger over the top of the bottle and shake it, boy, you get very pressurized soda and you can squirt it all over the room. Mechanical agitation of the soda water will make the carbon dioxide come out of solution and bubble to the top, so to speak, and now you've got this foamy substance you can be squirting all over the place. Mechanical agitation or increase in temperature, either one or the combination, will take in the carbon dioxide that's in solution, it comes out of solution, and it becomes gas on the top of the fluid. So when you tipped over that bottle of soda, you did a small, minor amount of mechanical agitation. Some of the carbon dioxide came out of solution. It filled up some of the space above the fluid. Now the total internal pressure of that bottle increased. Therefore, when you squeeze it, you notice that it doesn't squeeze anywhere as easily. And you can confirm this, that it's the extra pressure created by the carbon dioxide that bubbled out of solution because of the mechanical agitation. You can confirm that by loosening the cap, and you'll hear the extra pressure coming off, if you know what I mean. After you loosen the cap, you then squeeze the bottle again, and you'll notice that it squeezes very easily. So the fact that you can get so much cubic centimeters of gas to dissolve into the fluid, and when it's dissolved into the fluid, it doesn't change the volume of the fluid. The carbon dioxide molecules are sitting in between the water molecules, and it doesn't increase the volume of the fluid. And of course, that sounds kind of crazy. What's really going on is that you and I think that that fluid is a completely filled space substance at the atomic level. There's a lot of spacing in between all of those water molecules, so to speak. And the carbon dioxide molecules can go in there without changing the volume of the whole container. There's a little bit of magic going on there. That's my understanding of this. Drag your feet a little bit, John, as I pass it back to you, because I'm not convinced I've read the whole story. KC2WGB, I'm not that much of a chemist. K2RIW in the TechNet. Question. Yeah, go ahead, Wes.
Okay. Why then CO2 mix back with the liquid? Cannot mix back with the liquid after the soda bottle has been shaken. Address you.
In the old days, we used to buy these seltzer water generating devices. It was a very high pressure glass bottle with a metal cage around it just to make sure that if the bottle exploded, it wouldn't be creating a glass shrapnel all over the place. You took a CO2 container, a CO2 cartridge, and screwed it into a portion of the seltzer making device. And the CO2 was forced under high pressure to bubble through the water, and that forced the CO2 to dissolve into the water, and you now had seltzer water. So if the pressure of the CO2 bubbling through the fluid is high enough, you will force some of the CO2 molecules in between the water molecules, and you'll be generating seltzer water. There's a certain minimum pressure required to do that. It is my belief that you and I could take a bottle of soda off the shelf at a store. Let me drop it. That is thoroughly sealed. You squeeze that bottle and you will sense a certain amount of pressure. You then shake the living daylights out of that bottle of soda without opening the cap. Try to re-squeeze it. You'll discover that it's very difficult to squeeze. There's a huge pressure inside now because some of that carbon dioxide has come out of the fluid because of the mechanical agitation. And if you put that bottle of soda that you have just shaken back on the shelf and you leave it there for a day, during that day, because of the high pressure, some of that carbon dioxide will slowly redissolve back into the water. And tomorrow, that bottle of soda will seem completely normal to you, like you've never shaken it. But it takes time for that combination. Depending on what rate you want the CO2 to go into the water, There's a certain amount of pressure you've got to supply to do it at that rate. And so, ordinarily, a bottle of soda, let me drop it. That bottle of soda that's on the shelf in that store got there because it arrived on a truck and a train and whatever. In the process of it being shipped, it had all kinds of mechanical agitation. And for all we know, the guy who took that case of soda bottles and he wanted to take it off the truck and put it onto his hand truck, he dropped it on the ground and let it go clunk. And he created all kinds of mechanical agitation. As long as you wait long enough, that extra pressure in the bottles will slowly, that extra carbon dioxide will slowly dissolve back into the water if you wait long enough. N2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. That's the right explanation. The dissolved CO2 in the liquid is in greater concentration than the liquid can hold for that pressure. So, there's no evaporation seats for the bubbles that form. When you shake it, actually, you could see that you have bubbles, but not really as many in it. There is, however, the superheating that is taking place. Actually, it's not really like that. It is a similar thing to the superheated water where you have across the thresholds for the phase transition. And you have a certain impurities to initiate the process of the liquid, and that what is happening. So if you disturb the liquid, it will produce bubbles. And then if you first shake the bottle and open up, then open it, then you are agitating that fluid with form of bubbles of CO2 with, and the pressure drops. So, yes, I agree with you. When you just put it on the table, don't shake it, don't then change the temperature. With the time, that CO2 will dissolve back to equalize the form of the pressure to the previous condition and to exceed.
Now, even if the bottle of soda that was sealed at the factory became mechanically agitated, and a lot of the CO2 came out of solution and became extra pressure above the fluid, it will slowly dissolve back in if you leave it alone for a day or so, and the rate at which it dissolves back in will increase if you cool the soda. The amount of carbon dioxide that can be dissolved into water is a crazy relationship. The colder the water, the more carbon dioxide you can dissolve into it. Correspondingly, if you started heating your soda, even without mechanical agitation, some of that carbon dioxide will come out of solution. So it's a peculiar relationship of pressure and temperature and time and mechanical agitation as to how much carbon dioxide is dissolved into your soda water. You can force a bottle of soda to go flat very fast, even if it's cold, by shaking it and slowly releasing the pressure. You know, you're putting your thumb over the top of the bottle and you shake it and slowly release the pressure and shake it again and slowly release the pressure. You can take a cold bottle of soda and force it to go flat. Probably you could do that whole process in 5 or 10 minutes and you could make a really sweet tasting substance that you wouldn't like. But that's the real amount of sugar that's really there. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Good explanation. I'm amazed that somebody that young could discover something like that and, you know, ask the question. That's fascinating. And another thing, the fact that you can take a specific amount of liquid, put it in a bottle, and then charge it with CO2 and not increase the volume of the liquid. That's also very interesting. I wasn't aware of that. Very good. Let me let it drop and I'll go on to the next bigger question.
Yeah, what you're proving, John, is that inside of every real ham radio operator, in my opinion, there is a scientist fighting to get out. Take a real ham radio operator, a guy with curiosity about everything. Why does the moon do that? Why does my bottle of soda do that? Why does my antenna do that? Why does my transmission line do that? Why does my receiver or transmitter do that? Why does Mother Nature's propagation do that? Why does that radio wave go 8 billion miles or whatever the number is to Voyager and come all the way back to Earth, and we can still read that signal 37 years later, 120 astronomical units? How in the world can that signal go that far and still be readable? That is the most QRP DX station mankind has ever created, and the story ain't over yet. It's still moving away from us at a zillion miles an hour, and the distance is continuously increasing. We haven't heard the end of that story yet, John. KC2WGB, K2RAW.
That's one of man's finest journeys that he set out there. Yeah, I think 21 billion, something like that. I'll pull and give us an update on it, I'm sure. All right, I'll let it drop. Let me go on to the next one. Okay, this is a lieutenant question that he has heard the discussion many times about the RF signal being sent up the current carrying conductor, the cable, launches onto the antenna, and bounces back and forth, whatever the cue is, 20 times, 10 times, and then radiates. Okay, he understands that. But his question is, why doesn't that bouncing travel on the wire too? Why isn't that bouncing? And this is a gentleman, let's see, he's 16 years old, this gentleman. So, and he'd like you to explain that if possible. And you take it over there to KC2WGB, back to you.
Yeah, whenever we go to the next step of discovering how a dipole works, and this is going to be one of my illustrations on this talk that I'm tooling up to give for for the last 3 quarters of the year. I've been promising the guys at the IEEE Long Island Consultants Network that I'm going to give a presentation on the subject of antennas from a real engineering useful information point of view, from a person who really designs antennas on a day-to-day basis. And for 10 solid years, I was doing that, designing antennas every single day. And so what techniques worked for me, what the rules of thumb worked for me, what techniques for impedance matching and getting the right resonance and so on, what ways of tuning an antenna worked for me, which are very different than everything that was taught to me by any of the schools I've gone to, and quite different by any of the books that I've read. Let me drop. And there was a incident that occurred at the laboratory that I was at about 3 years ago, where a major organization in the United States that makes a whole lot of radio equipment had the chairman of the antenna design department, who had quite a few anechoic chambers with people running those chambers, in his department. So he had something like 10 or 15 antenna engineers working for him, using about 10 different anechoic chambers in this organization. So this man came to the East Coast to visit our installation on Long Island, and looked at the very simple procedure that I was using for designing these three-element 915 megacycle Yagis. And he looked at my so-called antenna range and rolled his eyes and assumed that this was a craziness, and turned around. He's about to walk out of the room. And I called to him and said that each time I interview a potential antenna designing engineer, I ask him a particular puzzle to tell me whether or not he understands how an antenna works. Would you like to see what that puzzle is? He was kind of curious. He turned around and said, yeah, show it to me. So I walk over to the whiteboard, and I drew a simple dipole, which consists of a 72-ohm transmitter, 72-ohm twin lead, and a half-wave dipole antenna. And the twin lead was really made out of 14-gauge wire at just the right spacing, so that the twin lead had 72 ohms of impedance, and the quarter wave pieces of, I mean the 16-gauge pieces of wire made a right-angle bend for the right-hand side of the dipole, and a left-hand bend, a right-angle bend. So you've got 16-gauge, 14-gauge wire throughout the transmission line and the antenna. All that happens is a bend when the transmission line ends and the dipole begins. And the dipole was mechanically made to be exactly electronically a half-wavelength
repeater. Time out.
So I told him this is a steady-state problem. An antenna is 72 ohm impedance. Therefore, there's a one-to-one standing wave ratio. There's no reflected energy in this antenna that has been running for a long time. And the transmitter is 72 ohm balanced. And I said, the very next cycle of energy coming out of the transmitter, because it's 72 watts on a 72 ohm line, that means it's exactly 72 volts at exactly 1 ampere coming out of the transmitter. The very next cycle, by some magic, I make them out of red electrons instead of blue electrons, so to speak. And whether or not the very next cycle of energy, whether or not you consider it a cycle of voltage, a cycle of current, or a cycle of energy, if you make it 72 nanowatts of nanojoules of energy, because it's we're running at 1 gigahertz. At 1 gigahertz, 1 cycle is 1 nanosecond. So 72 watts really means 72 joules per second is flowing into the transmission line. If you're only looking at one cycle of it, one nanosecond, the 72 nanojoules. So 72 nanojoules of energy, 72 volts of volts, 1 ampere of volt. Use any units you want. The very next cycle going down that transmission line is made out of red electrons, where all the other electrons are blue in this Gedanken experiment. Let me drop. So I told him this is a slow motion movie and you're watching it happen. And the steady state has been running for a long time. You watch that cycle of energy go down the transmission line, it hits the antenna, turns the corner, and starts flowing down the wire of the antenna. And I asked him what happens next. And I stopped talking. For the next 10 seconds, there was dead silence. The view on his face is what I call the deer in the headlights. All the training and the 20 years of experience of running that antenna department had come crashing down on him. He didn't feel he had an answer to that. And the two other engineers he brought with him are staring at him because they're thinking to themselves, this is a fairly simple sounding question. Here's the head of our department. He's being asked this question by this crazy guy on Long Island, and he didn't hear an answer. And after the 10 seconds, his answer was, why the hell would I want to know that? To which I told him that of those 5,000 kinds of antennas, 4,000 of them have somewhere in them a dipole or a monopole as the major exciting element that makes the antenna work. You've got 10 or 15 engineers working for you day in and day out designing antennas and impedance matching them. And there's a basic element in every one of those antennas that is a dipole. They better understand how a dipole works, otherwise they're wasting your money and wasting your time. I said, this is very important information. What really happens in the middle of that dipole, and what do you have to do to make impedance match? That stopped him. And he said, after another 5 seconds of silence, he said, I'll get back to you on this. That's an interesting question. And he was walking out of the room with his two other engineers. I expected him now to communicate to me. I waited 2 weeks, nothing. I recomposed the problem as a email and sent it to him and said, what is your answer on this? Nothing. Nothing came back. At first, I thought he is foolish.
Repeater, time out.
At first, I thought he was foolish, and I suddenly realized he's not foolish, he's a victim. I was a victim. I had been working as an antenna engineer for a number of years because I finally figured out from my point of view, what's going on? I've got a mental image as to what really happens. What really happens is that energy from the transmitter, as it turns the corner, goes down that wire of the dipole, hits the end, and comes back. Takes a quarter wavelength of time, because it's a quarter wavelength of wire to the right and to the left. Takes a quarter wavelength of time to come down to the open circuit. Roughly 5% of that energy gets radiated on the first pass. 95% of the energy is left over, and it reflects back. Another 5% gets radiated. So 90% of the energy is still left when it comes back to the center of the dipole. Because it took a quarter wavelength of time to go down, a quarter wavelength of time to come back, it comes back in a half wavelength of time. By then, the positive voltage coming out of the transmitter has just turned into negative voltage. You're a half wavelength in time downrange. You're looking at the other half of the cycle. So you've got positive voltage reflecting coming back, meeting the negative voltage coming out of the transmitter at that time. That's almost a short circuit. So the majority of that reflected energy thinks it's seeing an almost perfect short circuit and gets re-reflected forward toward the tips of the dipole again. You're now looking at the process by which the energy bounces back and forth 10 times. Let me drop. That energy bounces back and forth 10 times before it finally gets radiated. The fact that all of those bounces are co-phased with each other, they're in step with each other, that is the definition of resonance. You've chosen the right length. So all those 10 bounces are all in step with each other of all the previous pieces of energy that were put into that antenna. The bottom line of all that is, I'm rounding off the numbers a little bit, the current in the center of the dipole is roughly 10 amperes, even though the transmission line supplies only 1 ampere. The transmission line has got 72 watts on it. It's a 72-ohm transmission line, so there's 72 volts at 1 ampere on the transmission line. Because of all the bounces in the dipole, there's 10 amperes flowing in the center of the dipole. And the 72 volts that the dipole is being fed from the transmission line, because the Q is 10, that means there's 720 volts between the tips of the dipole. Q is defined as voltage rise at resonance, current rise at resonance. So the center of the dipole has 10 times more current, the tips of the dipole have 10 times more voltage. But let's just talk about that current. The advantage of that 10 amperes of current, let me drop, is now the magnetic field created by the current is 10 times stronger than it would be. That's what really enables the radiation to take place. The 10 times higher current, 10 times stronger magnetic field, launches that very strong magnetic field into space, and that's really what's doing the radiating. That's the mechanism by which you resonate first, then you can radiate, because resonance gives you this multiplication of current. And now you're about to say, what about Kirchhoff's law? I got the exact same piece of 16-gauge wire going up there as twin lead, that's the transmission line. I make a bend, and all of a sudden it's now 16-gauge wire that makes the dipole. Kirchhoff's law would lead you to believe that 1 ampere from the transmission line can't be 10 amperes on the dipole, because the exact same piece of wire an inch further downrange. At first you would say, you're violating Kirchhoff's law. You watch the right program from Dr. Lewin. What's his first name? Walter Lewin. You watch the Walter Lewin MIT lecture on physics, where he describes what happens with the violation of Kirchhoff's law when you've got a local magnetic field. The current in the wire of the dipole is very similar to what happens if you put your thumb in the direction of the current and your fingers wrapping around the wire are where the magnetic lines of force around that dipole are flowing. Those magnetic lines of force, let me drop. Those magnetic lines around the dipole are at right angles to the transmission line. They do not couple to the transmission line. Those are two independent events. The current of the dipole and the current of the transmission line are two independent events, even though they're the exact same piece of 14-gauge wire. Of course that sounds crazy, but you watch that Walter Lewin demonstration of how the current flowing in a piece of wire here is different than a current flowing in the exact same piece of wire over there because of a local non-conservative magnetic field. Non-conservative magnetic field means that under normal circumstances, the strength of the magnetic field tells you how much voltage is induced into the wire by way of Faraday's law. Faraday's law, Kirchhoff's law, is true if and only if there is no local magnetic field, particularly not a non-conservative magnetic field. Non-conservative magnetic field means that the voltage you induce in your wire is a function of what path you take. Take a different path, even though you're going through the exact same magnetic field, but a different portion of it, you'll end up with a different voltage. Those magnetic lines of force around that dipole are at right angles to the transmission line. Therefore, Kirchhoff's law will not be maintained. Kirchhoff's law is a special case when there is no magnetic field. In the case of a magnetic field, the only thing you can depend on is Faraday's law. How strong is the magnetic field? Is it at right angles to the wire? Tells you how much voltage is induced into the wire. So, because of the non-coupling. Now, there are people who have run the experiment where they take a small loop of wire at the end of a piece of miniature transmission line. Let me drop.
Let me just ask Lou, NY2H, if you're still out there. W2BL is in conference mode.
Okay, I'll try to remedy that. I might have to drop everybody, but they could come back in. And Dick, maybe how does this relate to radiation resistance? Is there a corollary?
The answer is almost no, Lou, and that's another whole couple of steps to get there, and I don't want to break away from this one yet. There are people who have now run a real measurement. They have put a small loop of wire in the end of a piece of miniature transmission line. They put it near the center of a dipole like the one I'm describing. By the magnetic coupling into that calibrated loop that I just described, into good instrumentation, like an oscilloscope, you will confirm that 10 amperes is flowing in the center of that wire of that dipole. And you're doing a non-invasive measurement when you do that correctly. And by similar kinds of E-field probes, you can probe the tips of the dipole, and you'll find that 720 volts is there. You'll be confirming the dipole has a Q of 10, that it's multiplying the voltage at the tips by 10, and it's multiplying the current in the center by 10. You can confirm that with real measurements. I've read articles where guys have done that. Unfortunately, they didn't go the next step. They didn't bring that current measuring device near the side of the wire of the twin lead to confirm that only 1 ampere is flowing in the exact same piece of wire, but you now hold it near the twin lead, the 72 ohm twin lead, and you confirm that there's 1 ampere there. Walter Lewin, in one of his experiments, it's an MIT YouTube video that you can see, demonstrates this with real measurements in the front of his laboratory at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. A number of the other professors of the physics department sitting in that audience, he tells us that other professors of the physics department sitting in the audience watching this demonstration said, that can't possibly be right, there must be an error. To which Lewin said, here is the Faraday law equations by which I say that it happens. Here is the real measurement. There's a real oscilloscope. There's a real current sending probe. There's a real solenoid coil. There's a real magnetic field. This is the real measurement we made. If you think what I've said is an error, and because what I'm demonstrating to you with real laboratory instrumentation that's calibrated is confirming the results, Walter Lewin then said, you guys have now got to tell me where is the error if you think there's an error. You see it with your own eyes, with real instrumentation, in front of this audience of 150 students, plus you professors. Where is the error if you think there is one? Of course, they were quiet. And I guess if you had quizzed each one of them, they would have said, I'll get back to you. But I guarantee they didn't. So this is one of the crazy laws of Faraday's law. Kirchhoff's law, a very good law, where you measure the current around the loop of a completely closed circuit. Let me drop. And the current in a completely closed circuit, following Kirchhoff's law, must add to zero. When you add all the positive and negative voltages and currents, the current is a known number, and the voltages have to all add to zero. That's Kirchhoff's law. But Kirchhoff's law is a special case when there is no changing local magnetic field. This dipole has a changing local magnetic field. Kirchhoff's law is out the window. In fact, the way Walter Lewin words it, I think he says, Kirchhoff's law in this situation is garbage. Only Faraday's law holds. So yes, this is opposite of any reasonable common sense. I know of no book that gives a good explanation of this. I've seen people writing articles where they've made some of the measurements and saw some of the current multiplication and voltage multiplication, but they didn't put it all together. They didn't explain that the current in the dipole is 10 times higher than the current in the feed line that's feeding the dipole, if it was 72 ohm feed line. So they didn't close the whole story from my point of view. So as simple as a dipole is, the most basic antenna in the world, the Heinrich Hertz dipole. Here we are 160 years downrange from when he so-called invented that thing, and we're still discussing how the hell it happens at the molecular level, what's going on inside. And let me drop.
And comment.
And people who run an antenna designing department of a major corporation, who have got other antenna engineers working for them day in, day out in anechoic chambers, building these antennas, testing them, impedance matching them, and making them work over the right bandwidth. Those people are not foolish. They are victims. They all have not been given a logical explanation, a rational explanation as to what goes on inside of that dipole. Now, I'm not positive I'm right. I'm giving you my mental image that has worked for me, by which I have designed a hell of a lot of antennas. It may be a flawed diagram, a flawed process of explanation, but but it fits the measurements that I've made with a good Rodin-Schwarz vector network analyzer and a good Hewlett-Packard spectrum analyzer and so on. It fits. I've got this mental image. I've given you the mental image that